Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, Thomas Bacchia. We are here at PubKey for a very special edition of How to Fix It at the Bulwark. Thomas, the purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly fixating on the problems, because that's frankly boring and exhausting.
Yeah.
So we're actually in a room on top of your bar, PubKey, which is in New York's Greenwich Village, which is created, it's kind of become the clubhouse of the crypto scene, certainly here in New York, but is nationally, internationally known. Donald Trump came by during the campaign. You're not a partisan. You're a disruptor, but you've also, in addition to having one of the top five cheeseburgers in New York, important shout out, you created a destination, a place for people to come physically and congregate around what is a digital decentralized movement.
Yeah.
Crypto is booming. It has been growing exponentially for a long time.
Yep.
You and I met last year because I was deeply committed to this idea that, first of all, you can't make new technology partisan.
Yep.
Making crypto partisan would be bad for American competitiveness.
Yeah.
And you were in agreement. And there was a lot of righteous anger at the Biden administration, particularly Gary Gensler, for kind of not creating clear rules of the road.
Yeah.
Now you've got kind of a boomtown mentality, but it seems to open the door to a lot of concerns about corruption or manipulation that because crypto could become partisan.
Yeah.
And that to me is counter to where we need to go. So first of all, thanks for hosting us here.
Thanks for being here.
Your joint.
Thank you.
Give me your sense of the state of crypto today, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
So how long do we have? So there is a big difference between Bitcoin and broader crypto,
yes.
Right? Broader crypto typically is a new project that is either a group of founders, a single founder, or a company. They do resemble securities in many ways. That's been an issue hammered back and forth by the SEC and crypto investors for a long time. But Bitcoin was sort of just, you know, released to a small group of cypherpunks and, you know, developers and engineers a long time ago with a, you know, anonymous founder who disappeared a couple of years after it was released. It has a hard-coded supply schedule. So it resembles a commodity much more so than a security. And because of that, there is, you know, a much bigger gap between a Bitcoin project or a company that's building on Bitcoin or the protocol itself and all these crypto projects that are out there. That can be a confusing distinction for a lot of folks when they're just starting out and just starting to realize that this is something that's pretty impactful and worth paying attention to. But some people do gloss over that, and crypto gets Bitcoin bundled into it sometimes when it
right.
shouldn't necessarily. Crypto projects are generally concerned. Here at PubKey, we focus just on Bitcoin. That's not to say that all crypto projects are garbage and worthless and not paying attention to. It's just not really our area of expertise. We stick to Bitcoin and, you know, the Bitcoin protocol and folks that are building on Bitcoin.
So Bitcoin is still sort of the gold standard. I mean, there's Ethereum, there's other sort of early.
Sure.
But now you've got these proliferations of what are sometimes called shit coins, meme coins.
Yeah.
and Donald Trump went from in 2021, not that long ago, calling Bitcoin a scam, crypto
yeah.
a scam, to being an evangelist for it. And now actually a majority, by some estimates, of his family's wealth is tied up in meme coins and crypto in general.
Yeah.
Are you concerned that that will ultimately hurt the credibility of Bitcoin?
So, yes, ultimately, that's why I started where I started by trying to explain that there is a gulf of difference between the two, Bitcoin and broader crypto. That doesn't really matter, right? It gets bundled together for a lot of folks. A lot yeah. of potential regulators and politicians will look at it as one thing. So it's part of our responsibility within the Bitcoin community to help people, you know, come up that curve. People generally hate it when they first learn about it, but, you know, they first hear about it, they don't really dig in. When they they dig in and you do the work to understand the mechanisms underpinning Bitcoin's technology and some of the problems that it could potentially solve. I've met very, very few people that remain skeptics when they do the work and actually dive into the technology itself. Broader crypto is definitely rife with scams. Not to say that the, you know, Trump family coins are scams. You know, there is a concern. There's a lot of, I would say, case law in broader crypto where we've seen, you know, really bad actors, you know, dumping on retail and, you know, running away with funds. This family is far more public. You know, I have not really diligenced these projects. Like I said, this is sort of out of scope for me. I hope it doesn't go down that line because it would be a headache for Bitcoiners for sure.
Right.
So, yeah.
I mean, that's one of the deals here, right? I mean, yeah. There was a bill in 2024, had 70 Democrats support it, 3 Republicans opposed it, but it looked like we were heading towards more broad bipartisan consensus that crypto and specifically Bitcoin is here.
Yeah.
And all the industry and investors were asking for were some clear rules of the road.
Yeah.
That the Biden administration did not deliver on, certainly Gary Gensler at the SEC in particular.
Yeah.
So now we're on the other side of the election and that Rubicon. What in your perfect world, what kind of regulation do you think is needed to preserve or strengthen the guardrails around Bitcoin, around crypto in general, to make sure that this thing is protected, that investors are protected and the credibility is enhanced, not diminished?
That's a great question. And it hits on a lot of different areas. So the Biden administration also had the debanking, you know, scandal or whatever we're calling
Explain
it
Explain that
now.
To folks. Yeah.
So a lot of people were losing their bank accounts simply because they interacted with, you know, crypto exchanges. They were buying and selling Bitcoin. Bitcoin and crypto businesses lost their accounts because they were, you know, offering goods and services, you know, related to this industry. It was a pretty targeted, approach to enforcement. It wasn't even really enforcement. So I got debanked twice. I had a crypto fund prior to PubKey, and PubKey also was a client of Signature Bank, which was one of the banks that was shut down as part of this operation. Hopefully we get more information out of that and who was really behind it. I think that there are some looks into that, but we'll right. see where that goes. So here in New York, we have the BitLicense. The BitLicense is basically a third level of money transmitter and money service business licenses. What that ends up doing is adding a tremendous amount of compliance and complexity for legal risk and compliance offices or departments within exchanges or anybody that's dealing with crypto or Bitcoin. That historically has caused a lot of, I would say, industry-leading companies to not offer their services to New York state residents. And if you look at the terms of services, it's kind of funny. It's like North Korea, Iran, South Sudan, and New York State, which is kind of sad as a New Yorker.
By the way, from a New York competitive standpoint, you cannot be in that company.
You don't want to be in that company, and I think it's a bit ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. That we're doing it. Just please, New York. Like, you know, if you look at the founding of our state and our city, it's always been a very entrepreneurial place to have rules and regulations in place that are hostile to entrepreneurs outside, you know, just basic consumer protections, which I don't think, you know, lumping us in with those three countries would indicate we're an outlier.
Yeah, I think
not it's a best practice.
It's not great.
Crazy.
It's pretty crazy.
All right.
So going. Lots of businesses don't come here. You know, the state loses out on corporate tax revenue. We don't have jobs and offices and all those things. It doesn't make any sense. And it's also causing New Yorkers to miss out on this technological revolution. So dismantling the BitLicense, I think, is number one. Number two, a de minimis tax exemption for Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, where if somebody wants to sell a little bit, it's cash, it's digital cash, it should be treated as such. I know that that's part of the talks that are ongoing in Washington. I think that's taken a backseat to some of the stablecoin stuff and you know, the strategic reserve and those things. Those will be nice to have, but I think, you know, clarity around tax treatment and de minimis exemptions makes a lot of sense and will really foster a tremendous amount of innovation within the country. And I think we want to keep it here because people need to realize it's not just the U.S. Everybody else is competing for Bitcoin as well. And it just will go offshore.
This is such an important point, by the way, because I went to a crypto conference just because I wanted to get smarter on the issues. And you could see other countries, other regions saying, look, the U.S. is falling behind, like come invest with us. And that's just from a national economic standpoint, from a national competitiveness standpoint, is being on the back foot. So what is Europe doing right that the U.S. can take note from?
Well, I don't necessarily think Europe's doing anything right.
What are the countries or regions that are doing regulation right?
Singapore and Dubai. Okay. Singapore and Dubai, I think, are getting a lot of innovators, and you know, some of the most successful companies are popping up there. So I think deregulation is really important. And I also think something else that we should be taking a closer look at is dismantling the Patriot Act and the Bank Secrecy Act almost entirely. So, you know, compliance has offloaded the enforcement side of, you know, financial crime to effectively banks. And they quite enjoy it because they can have a regulatory moat and they can keep out, you know, new challengers. The incumbents always win because they'll just staff up in legal risk and compliance. But in crypto, we've seen two major hacks for this database, all this personal information of customers that they're required to collect because of the Bank Secrecy Act and the Patriot Act. But if they don't store that properly, that puts clients and people that hold Bitcoin and crypto at tremendous risk. So Ledger, a hardware wallet, they got hacked and their database of all of their, you know, customers was released into the wild. But just a couple of months ago, same thing happened to Coinbase. So, you know, that coincides with an increase in what we call $5 wrench attacks, where people basically just beat you up and, you know, tell you to open up your Bitcoin wallet and transfer to theirs, which is a sad thing. So Jesus. I think that we need to revisit the real intent, particularly with other things. I think that if we had a sober conversation around the collection of personal information, whether it's Web 2.0 or Palantir or whatever, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense right now. So I know that that's a bit of a jarring statement to make. I don't think there's a single politician in Washington that would touch the Bank Secrecy Act and, you know, put forth something that would be either a substantial revision or repeal. There are a couple of politicians that are talking about repealing the Patriot Act. So, you know, there's progress in that direction, but that's also a big one, I think, within the Bitcoin community.
So, you know, there's the Genius Act, which is being debated in the Senate.
Yeah.
As we're recording this in early June. And they do have national security provisions, and they do, I believe one of their proposals is to, and I know The Economist has advocated this, you know, treating stablecoin, you know, sort of like a bank security, at least to protect investors, right? Because stablecoins, you can't have runs on the coin. What do you think of that?
Clarity around that's going to be great. It also has some rules that'll be important to exchanges in sort of clarifying, you know, their normal course of business and tax treatment and stuff like that. Clarity helps for sure. You know, with stablecoins, it's a bit of a tricky issue. We have USDC from Circle, which is the largest onshore, and then Tether, which is the largest offshore. This is of a national security interest level, you know, policy debate, because it does help with the proliferation of US dollars into markets that, you know, maybe are not getting proper service from correspondent banking networks. So there's two things that are going on there. Keeping that innovation on shore, but also blasting dollars everywhere in the world is something that's really good for, I think, our treasury.
One would think that would be a real, I mean, priority, because there is a real danger about, frankly, you know, the dollar being replaced with the world reserve currency.
Yeah.
And anything that can strengthen the dollar as a common currency is a good thing, even if it's an underpinning.
Yeah. Look, at this point, Tether and Circle hold more T-bills than some, you know, pretty sizable nations.
That's
so
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the promises in talking to folks who are, you know, Bitcoin enthusiasts, investors, is the virtue of transparency.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the skeptical arguments had been people can use these coins to get around sanctions. mm-hmm. right? And there's just a case involving a company called Evita, where a Russian individual allegedly, you know, this is being ongoing, was, you know, moved like $500 million out of, you know, out of countries through Bitcoin wallets to sure. evade sanctions.
Sure.
What are your thoughts about the protections against that?
I think we're thinking about it the wrong way. I think okay. that we can address issues without making, you know, the primary tool the, you know, financial system and okay. the correspondent banks. I don't think it's going to work. Certainly not in the world where Bitcoin exists and Bitcoin continues to develop. And we need to shift enforcement back to, I would say, an older mode where, you know, we're addressing problems head on. The soft power has other elements of corruptibility embedded in it. Central bankers are going to print. We're going to run into inflation issues. There's always going to be a workaround with these systems. I mean, you know, cartels still have large bank accounts, right? Like right. They're able to still go through these things. It just creates an uglier system that is much more unwieldy and difficult to manage. Bitcoin has a level of transparency. It's very difficult to run away forever if you're involved with a crime with Bitcoin, because you do have these touch points that you can use to triangulate the activity and the flow of funds. So, you know, you can move quickly, you can run, but you're not going to be able to hide, you know, forever when you have it. So we do have some of the things when you're looking at sort of blockchain analysis and other, you know, touch points. If they're buying and selling large amounts of Bitcoin, they have to go to an exchange. The exchange is going to collect some data anyway on the customer. They'd be able to flag transactions. We have technological solutions for the flow of funds that are far superior to, let's say, the SWIFT network.
So what would those be?
Well, it's a bearer asset, so you're able to track it a little bit easier. When you send a wire internationally, it just goes. Like there's no tracking it after that. So it's an upgrade over SWIFT. But I do think that, you know, I'd like to see a better conversation in Washington where we're talking about the efficacy of, I would say, the Bank Secrecy Act and the Patriot Act as it pertains to financial, you know, compliance, KYC, AML items.
But so you, but just to be clear, you think that then the use of Bitcoin or other forms of crypto to evade sanctions is better enforced through legal enforcement rather than through banking regulation? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And I'm genuinely like, you're the expert here. I want to learn from you and people learn from you about from your perspective what the right things to do.
There's always going to be something to get around sanctions. Bitcoin exists. There's no unringing that bell. We can take ourselves out of the mix and we can, you know, we can ban it just like China has tried to ban it many, many, many times right. over the last 10 years. It's just not going to work. So it's a paradigm shift that we need to approach with, you know, a fresh pair of eyes. And, you know, have a real assessment of what's working and what's not.
Who are the political leaders you think who get it? Not from a self-interested standpoint, but from a, you know, you think are clear-eyed on this sort of thing.
Richie Torres, yep. New York representative, Cynthia Lummis, senator out of Wyoming. Ted Cruz did a lot of work. He had a bit of an advantage because there is a link between the energy industry and Bitcoin mining. So he dove at it from that angle and came up the curve really quickly. There are a bunch that are starting to get it. You know, we're going to be opening PubKey DC in a couple of months. And we're really focused on the staffers, the interns, the lobbyists, because, you know, it might be unrealistic to expect policymakers to do a really deep dive into Bitcoin and understand.
It shouldn't be, but okay.
It shouldn't be, but I think it might be. And there are edge cases, right? I think Richie and Senator Lummis are definitely edge cases that are at the forefront of this and deeply understand the mechanisms at play here and also the benefits. Most importantly, the benefits to American citizens and America on a global stage. But I think it still is a battle for the staffers and the interns and the folks that are basically just, you know, charged with figuring out this new weird money that's on the internet.
What about one of the arguments was, you know, we obviously are coming out of a high inflationary period, but with tariffs on the horizon looming,
sure.
You know, part of the hope had been that Bitcoin would be a hedge on inflation. When we had sort of that brief major spike as a result of the initial tariff threats, it didn't seem to respond as advertised, but you know, it is untethered.
Yeah.
from the dollar. So how, is it an alternative to gold in some respects? Because there's a limited amount that that can't be, you know, unlike other cryptocurrencies, more Bitcoin can't be made. Or is that still unproven? How do you think about that?
Well, from the supply side, it's better than gold because you have a fixed and transparent supply schedule. We don't know if we're going to find more gold at the bottom of the ocean or in an asteroid or whatever. There is sort of an implied scarcity with gold, but there's an explicit schedule. There's an explicit a level of scarcity with Bitcoin that we can see and audit at any moment. That's the benefit of the Bitcoin blockchain and that supply curve that Satoshi released. So it's far superior on the supply side. And then on the demand side or the usability side, the store of value argument is starting to come out. Bitcoin is still very, very young. But as a store of value, something that retains its purchasing power, I think over a long enough period of time, that's definitely true. But if you shorten sort of the time frame, it does have tremendous volatility. That's a product of how much is actually available, like available inventory on exchanges. It's really thin right now. Historically, there's not that much Bitcoin out there. And when you have swaps and derivatives and ETFs and all of these Bitcoin treasuries, the volatility can increase through like paper Bitcoin mechanisms. But the amount of actual Bitcoin that's circulating available for purchase is quite low. So you might have these pretty violent, you know, drawdowns for a short period of time, but you also have explosive upside if this continues to take on and people are just looking to acquire it.
So short-term volatility, longer-term more stability, but the idea that in an inflationary environment or in a major economic downturn that it would be a bond-like hedge, that's not the intent or function as far as we've seen it.
Nobody can make more. Nobody can find more. We have as much as we're going to have at any minute. There's new Bitcoin being released. Three Bitcoin and change are released every 10 minutes. On a four-year time frame, that's going to get cut in half. And then another 4 years, that gets cut in half. So there's no ability for a central bank to say, we need more liquidity. Bitcoin just is. And that's a really good counterbalance to central bankers. That really keeps them in check because, you know, I think one of the best ways to measure inflation is the price of Bitcoin.
Explain.
I think it's confidence in the system. It's sort of, you know, voting with where you want to hold your wealth. As Bitcoin continues to increase, more and more people are sort of expressing with their wallet that they're uncomfortable with the situation in equity markets, bond markets, you know, even in the bank account. If people choose to hold in Bitcoin, that's sort of a good indicator of their level of confidence for the financial system and also their, you know, government.
Are you concerned about, you know, the inflationary aspects of, or the dangers of deficit and debt? Is that a common concern among many Bitcoin holders and yourself?
Yeah. So Larry Lepard, a good friend of the pub, actually did his book launch here. Fantastic book called The Big Print. They're stuck. Like they're all intertwined. You know, I think everybody in high finance would agree that they're going to have to print. They're going to have to inject into the system at some point soon. There's really no way out. And I think, you know, the state in general has two addictions in throughout human history. One, the money printer, and two, the control of, you know, media and the dissemination of information. So I think that, you know, we're definitely in a situation. I think America is still the best country in the world as far as this is concerned. And we can look at other authoritarian dictatorships where they use, you know, the printing press and the control of media with a rather heavy hand. The U.S. is by far the best. However, in an uncertain period of time, you know, those two levers are going to be pulled at one point or another.
What lesson do you take from what happened in Argentina with sort of that sort of pump and dump scheme that the president got involved into?
I didn't look at that one too closely. I think that he just got caught up in something that, you know, he didn't fully understand. He definitely touched the stove. I'm not sure he's going to do that again. I think Milei is still a big supporter of Bitcoin, but, you know, he learned that lesson I was trying to articulate earlier about, you know, a big difference between these crypto projects and Bitcoin.
Right. And that's the key distinction. I mean, if you take one thing away from here, there is a fundamental difference between a lot of these meme coins and other things that, I mean, their value proposition is shady at best,
it's,
right?
It's a racetrack. Like, you know, it's a sports book at best. It's not even penny stocks. Like, and there are people that, you know, trade these markets and they're like deeply involved with these markets. They understand the liquidity and the flow. They're able to manipulate these things to a certain extent.
So what should the Fed do from your perspective?
What should the Fed do from my perspective?
Yeah, on you know, because there's been perpetual talk about, well, maybe we should have, you know, our own digital, you know, reserve currency. China's floated that, then pulled back. I mean, so sure. Just the Fed of it all, what's your perspective on the right approach? You know, if you were writing a memo to Jay Powell, what would you tell him?
I think that the digital euro, digital yuan are, they make sense because the dollar is already digital. The vast majority of dollars are digital within the banking system. We have USDC and Tether. So we already have sort of de facto, you know, digital dollars. I think it'd be a waste of time for the U.S. to focus on this. But I do understand that, you know, the ECB is, you know, pushing forward with their digital euro. They have to compete at some level. Like, they're just seeding this. The entire stablecoin market is being sort of given to the U.S. dollar for now. So I think that they can actually, you know, take a beat and not really waste a ton of time on a U.S. An official federal, like Fed coin or whatever, because we already have pretty good proxies for what that would ultimately achieve.
And you don't think that would hurt America's competitiveness because of our sort of comparative advantage on that front?
No, I don't think so.
Now, what do you think about countries like North Korea? You know, that you know, there's been, you know, it's inherently unknown given that they're a bit of a black box. But
yeah,
the idea that you know, authoritarian regimes can actually try to play these markets, manipulate these markets. You know, what are your thoughts, concerns about that?
Bitcoin is a tool. It's an internet protocol. And, you know, when there's something that is that good of an idea, it's like trying to keep hammers out of North Korea or fire. Like, it's just out there.
For as little as they have both hammers and fire.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this is a paradigm shift as far as internet technology is concerned. They have access to it. They have really elite hacking squads like Lazarus Group and other ones that have been, you know, very, very adept at stealing cryptocurrency and hacking into exchanges and things like that. We have to approach it from, you know, a completely new vantage point. Like, it's the new normal. So it's going to be very, very difficult. It's going to be impossible to prevent authoritarian dictatorships like Iran and North Korea from engaging with crypto because it's just an internet protocol.
How do you limit the downside of that? Or is that not even a profitable question?
Well, I think it's the supplies that go in. I think it's the real world, you know, rare earth minerals and, like, you know, all the things to build things. This is just internet money. You can't eat Bitcoin. You can't build weapons out of Bitcoin, but you can buy other stuff from other countries. So it's a different approach. I think focusing on Bitcoin, much like focusing on the, you know, the banking network, I think is a lost cause. I think if we want to prevent authoritarian dictatorships from accessing dangerous weapons and continuing to just horribly abuse their populations, then, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, talking about Bitcoin.
Are you concerned about their ability to manipulate the markets, or not more than any other?
Actor? No, not really. I don't think they're big enough or tapped in enough to actually manipulate the markets per se. They can hack exchanges, right?
Right.
And that goes back to, what are they getting?
Is it Mount Gox or Mount Go in Japan? That was an early case of hacking.
Yeah, Gox. There's been dozens. And a lot of these exchanges have gotten much, much better at private key management, how you keep Bitcoin secure and cryptocurrency secure. But they should also be doing that for their customers' data, right? If you have to scan your passport and your ID and take a picture with, you know, today's newspaper and all that stuff, they should be treating that the same way that they treat Bitcoin. But historically, that just doesn't happen. It's too much data. It's too widely available. You start thinking about the usability and what's good for the customer. So, you know, I'm more concerned about them getting access to that data than, you know, hacking for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, because those are pretty hardened practices at this point. That does still happen. And typically I recommend people do enough research to get to the point where they can hold their own Bitcoin, use multi-sig services, and get their Bitcoin off exchanges. because that's an attack vector. But, you know, I think that that's the extent of what like a North Korea would be able to accomplish here.
What do you think about Trump's call to create a strategic Bitcoin reserve? And,
yeah.
and how do you make sure, you know, I mean, it all depends also on the vehicle for doing that.
Sure, sure. I think it's smart. Like we have cheese. We have a cheese reserve. We have.
I didn't think you were going to go for the cheese reserve parallel. I like that. All right.
We have lots of stockpiles. And I do think that this is going to be a bit of an arms race across nation states here. And I think one premise for the United States is if you do live to see the day where you are in danger of losing the reserve currency status, the best case scenario is that somebody else doesn't get it. And that's Bitcoin right now. It's really only Bitcoin.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So you just wouldn't want to cede that control to China or EU or something like that.
What's China doing on Bitcoin and crypto writ large?
So they just banned. 2020, 2021 in COVID, China banned Bitcoin mining.
Right.
But they didn't ban it entirely. And you can see it reflected in the hash rate, the network of output, the output for, miners that are competing to earn Bitcoin, Bitcoin miners. A lot of that stayed online. So what it looks like from afar was really just sort of oversight and transparency into the Bitcoin miners that were located in China, a little bit more government control. That was primarily designed to clamp down on capital flight. They wanted to keep that capital in China. A couple of months ago, I believe, they just banned citizens from buying, selling, and holding Bitcoin and cryptocurrency as well. I think that that's aimed at the same thing. They want to, you know,
control
and knock down capital flight as well. So at a government level, the CCP, at a government level, the CCP is still deeply involved with Bitcoin, and they do have, you know, a lot of Bitcoin mining companies. We don't know how much they hold because they don't release that information, but I would imagine it's a decent amount.
All right, let's talk about, so let's go back to the Genius Act bill being negotiated now. Are on balance, do you think that's a good step forward just from clarity's perspective? What elements are you concerned about that you would tweak? And what elements do you think are right on and should be pursued?
It doesn't touch Bitcoin too much, the Genius Act. I think the conversation is great, particularly at the committee levels. You have a situation where politicians have to get smart on the technology and come up the curve, even if they don't want to. That's what they should be doing. That's what they're tasked to do. So the conversation has been tremendous. And I think that there is an incentive for a lot of politicians to get involved with this because we saw what happened in the last election. It wasn't just Trump versus Harris as far as Bitcoin and crypto is concerned. Sherrod Brown lost his seat, with huge support from the crypto industry to take him out because he was part of, I think, the contingent that was behind debanking and very anti-Bitcoin clarity and regulation. And there were a couple of other races as well. So I think the sentiment in Washington is, you know, this is an issue that you have a demographic, let's say like younger, mostly men, who typically are not the most reliable voters, really galvanized to get out there and get more involved in politics.
So let's do the Thomas Bacchia pub key approved, like here are the basic principles.
Yeah.
The basic regulatory principles and guardrails that you think should be advanced.
So Bitcoin businesses should have some light touch regulation, particularly around, you know, safeguarding cryptocurrency held for a customer, safeguarding, you know, that personal data that we talked about. Those are the top two ones. A lot of the other stuff is, you know, harmonizing and really deregulating a lot of stuff around money service businesses, money transmitter licensing. The BIT license in New York State has got to go. It's anti-innovation. It's really hurt New York State, as we talked about. Those will be big wins and, you know, much, much more simplistic approach from a tax perspective. You want to incentivize people that were early to this and care about it so that they keep developing. Like you don't want to create a situation where people make a certain amount of money in a thing and then they just, you know, go do something else. You want to keep those early innovators and those leaders incentivized to continue to develop this.
All right. I'm going to use an imperfect metaphor, but, you know, there was Glass-Steagall, you know, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, right?
Sure.
You know, And obviously the banks at that point were saying, look, we can't innovate. We need to be able to sort of combine these resources. And there was an argument of innovation within that traditional financial sector. But when you took away those guardrails that had been first put in place in the wake of the Great Depression, you know, not so long after, the whole house comes crumbling down, and then everyone's, you know, and people get hurt. Right?
Yeah.
Folks on Wall Street always seem to end up being fine by and large, but it's Main Street that gets screwed.
Yeah.
And you've got a Main Street view of Bitcoin, it seems to me, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So how do you, to what extent are you concerned that too much deregulation or will end up creating instability where people will get hurt and it will actually stop the progress in the long run?
The problem is fiat currency. Right.
This is where we go super libertarian. Yeah, that's cool.
Well, the problem is the printing press and the ability to manipulate, you know, government backed currencies. And that's historically been, you know, a problem as long as they've been around. Going back to ancient Rome, you can see the devaluation of currency by, you know, it's not all lead or all silver. They put some like lead in it and it feels the same, but it's not as valuable. We have that situation today. People on Main Street are not buying homes. They're not buying equities. They're, you know, saving in cash. The cash is losing its purchasing power. Bitcoin is an alternative. It's really the only exit for a lot of people. Making that more accessible and also investing in education so that people understand what it is would be a much better solution for most people.
From an education standpoint. And you think the simplest form of regulation, and from your perspective also a deregulation that takes a lot of the shackles off, you think actually the focus should be more on deregulation than regulation
in certain places. I do think that I do think that the Patriot Act and the Bank Secrecy Act have led to a really locked up and expensive environment. You don't have small companies challenging Coinbase. You don't have small companies, you know, getting into the mix because they have to deal with just mountains of regulation on the compliance side, on the risk side. Not all of those laws are applicable to Bitcoin. So some clarity around that is going to be super helpful. We don't want to lose consumer protections entirely.
So what are the right consumer protections?
The right consumer protections, we want to make sure that, you know, private key management, if you're holding private keys for an individual or a customer, there should be guardrails around that and how secure the exchange itself is, how big the exchange gets. Are they reporting proof of reserves and how much Bitcoin they actually hold, or are there paper Bitcoin embedded therein? There are lots of ways that these companies could, you know, eventually screw over, you know, their customers and clients.
And you want to make sure that is limited.
Yeah, that should be limited.
Yeah. And, sure. And any regulation around the meme coin, shit coin sort of, you know, or is that just treated as a hobby? It's not a real thing.
You know, the SEC was so concerned about the Bitcoin ETFs for so long that they really, you know, if they couldn't prove that Ripple was a security, I just think that speaks to the fecklessness of the SEC. Like these are clearly securities and they couldn't win that fight. So with meme coins, it's a little bit different. They're kind of like collectibles. They're like art projects. Like they have this carve out.
That's an interesting parallel.
Yeah. And this, we had Hester, SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce here last week. And, you know, she spoke about this a little bit. And, you know, meme coins are in this funky gray area where they're not quite securities, but they do have security like, you know, elements to them. We're going to need some seminal court cases. I don't think that the SEC is going to get this done. I think that it needs to be, you know, through common law and the evolution of, you know, how we approach securities laws.
Despite your concern about sort of regulation through litigation, which had been one of the prime complaints of the past, do you think when it comes to meme coin, that probably is the right path?
Yeah.
But when it comes to stable coins, Bitcoin, you think that's got to be actually, you know, getting legislation through Congress that is, I mean, I was thinking about, I was kind of smiling. You're almost like a, this is gets super nerdy, but you know, like kind of a Brandeisian libertarian, right? You know, you want a lot of competition, you know, but you want some clear rules of the road, but the emphasis has got to be on competition and avoiding the way that the curse of bigness can manipulate rules and regulations in ways that box out, you know, the little guy.
For the individual, it should look, the rules for Bitcoin for an individual should look, you know, a lot like physical cash. It should just be like that across the board. That's going to spur innovation. That's going to be a much better situation for the entire industry. And I think the benefits will accrue to America, you know, at large. When you're dealing with companies that are selling services, there should be some guardrails around that for sure. They shouldn't just be able to do whatever they want and hold, you know, the private keys in their sock drawer of like the CTO's apartment or anything along those lines. I think that's where they could be.
Has Singapore created sort of a model that works for you? Singapore is an imperfect parallel of the United States, but
it is imperfect. I mean, Singapore has the benefit of being able to access just about any exchange anyway. And I believe that they tapped into some of their largest banks to create, you know, crypto divisions and offer custody services and trading and things like that. You know, obviously the tax laws are far more favorable for businesses and entrepreneurs and individuals that want to participate in this ecosystem. So, you know, I think it comes back to the taxes. I think to incentivize people to build here and create jobs here and have offices here, we got to reassess that mechanism as well.
All right. So
it really touches everything. It's a hard question. I'm sorry if I'm not answering it.
It gets down to creating a framework in which you can encourage individual entrepreneurship, ingenuity, innovation. And if there's taxes are too high or regulation is too burdensome, when things are highly fungible, right?
Yeah.
They go elsewhere. This is why my core approach was, my core belief was like, you got to keep an eye on American competitiveness.
Yeah.
You can't just live in denial. And the other danger, which seems to me still pretty damn urgent, is that this can't be partisan. My concern right now is that because you got to let a thousand flowers bloom approach from this administration with the president and his family getting really rich off some of this stuff,
yeah,
that ends up hurting our ability to make this bipartisan and just sort of clear rules of the road that aren't overly burdensome.
Yeah.
And overregulation.
Yeah. So far, and we've hosted a lot of, you know, politicians. We've had, you know, Senator Lummis here, Senator Gillibrand was here right when we first opened,
yeah,
I think in the first couple of months.
She's very good on this issue.
She's great. We hosted a dinner for Richie Torres recently. One thing that I have noticed is the Republicans do have a little bit of an advantage right now. I would like to see more Democrats coming out and meeting the community and diving into this, because there does seem to be an asymmetry across party lines. And Bitcoin doesn't care. It's an internet protocol. Right. It really doesn't. And if you're just going to take yourself out of that game and lose a lot of voters who are very passionate about this new technology and this tool, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's really just a self-own. And that would be sad to see, because I think, you know, the entire country loses out if one of the two main parties just says Trump likes this thing, so we don't like that thing.
Yeah. And that's the echo chamber you got to get out of. And,
yep,
and to your point, I mean, you know, it's doubly ironic because Democrats used to be sort of the party of the future, right? The
100%.
Idea of progress versus being conservative was, you know, moving forward versus, you know, and there's a dynamic balance between the two. That's fine.
It's a surreal timeline at the moment.
But it's a surreal timeline. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, this is kind of a parlor game, and it may not matter at the end of the day, but there's a lot of questions around and theories around who the founder of Bitcoin is, who disappeared. A new book has a bunch of theses. You're in this deep, man. So what's your educated opinion or theory?
So it goes down, I guess, three buckets: an individual, a group of individuals, or potentially, you know, NSA or something like that. So one of the more credible theories, and, you know, this is not one that I necessarily subscribe to, but some folks really seem to think there's a lot of credibility to the lab leak theory. This was it was developed at the NSA along the lines of, if you're ever going to lose that that reserve currency status, it's better that it doesn't go to somebody else.
Huh.
And there were some papers in the 90s that came out of the NSA that are, you know, really spot on for some of the underlying mechanisms at play with Bitcoin today. There's a group of individuals that used to run a mailing list called the Cypherpunks that were trying to invent digital money. There are many, many precursors to Bitcoin, like eGold and, David Chalm's eCash and a lot of those just sort of like sputtered out. It wasn't until Satoshi combined a couple of different mechanisms like proof of work and, you know, the scarcity and supply schedule, the difficulty adjustment, that Bitcoin was released and it actually worked quite well. So it could have been either an individual, because that's where Satoshi first posted the white paper to. It was that cypherpunk mailing list, because those were the world experts at the time. Huh. The only people really diving into these to the creation of an internet protocol, digitally native monetary asset. But there's a lot of, prior art out there as well. So folks, maybe five or so people are cited in that white paper. Y-Day, Nick Szabo, Adam Back. Adam Back still works in Bitcoin as the CEO of Blockstream. You know, it's kind of like a take your pick. And it's one of the more interesting, whodunit.
Who's your candidate for Deep Throat?
I don't know. I don't know if I can say. We've had a lot of those candidates here at PubKey. You know, we've had Peter Todd here. Adam Back's been here. Probably NSA's been through here. we've had a lot of those folks come through. The really beautiful thing is it doesn't really matter, yeah. Right? Satoshi has no control over the direction of the protocol. He has no control over the operation of the protocol. Satoshi's wallets control a lot of Bitcoin. He has, amassed over 1 million Bitcoin that we know of in terms of wallets that were associated with Satoshi in the early days. Since Satoshi disappeared, they haven't moved once. People watch those wallets every single day. They're a really good canary in the coal mine. It's the biggest bounty in the world, and it's on an open source, internet protocol. It's kind of cool. If you think you can hack a Bitcoin wallet, go after Satoshi's and prove it. The beautiful thing about it is it doesn't matter who Satoshi was.
All right, listen, I think this is a clarifying conversation. It's broad, but it's really important.
Yep.
And it's hard for folks to get their head around, which is why I think your insights and your entrepreneurship and the fact you've created a physical space here at PubKey with a damn good cheeseburger.
Thank you.
But you can buy in Bitcoin or U.S. dollars.
Yeah. It's got to be a bar that people like being in. Good food and good drinks are really the bedrock for us.
I mean, that's what people want at the end of the day, right? Let's get together, rub elbows, have good conversations, have a good cheeseburger and a beer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thomas Bakke, appreciate you, man.
Thanks.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.